To me, it's the true things that are funny, okay? This is, I'm in the hotel, I order onion soup, I'm not good enough to make this up, okay? I'm eating my soup. The manager comes over, excuse me, sir, does that soup taste soapy or rancid to you? I swear, I don't know, why do you ask? And you know what he says? Never mind, and he left. He left. I'm sitting there. I know this guy's back in the kitchen. Yeah, put in more, Mr. Bubble. It's okay, I guess. I go in my room, and they have the remote control for the TV is bolted down to the desk. Like people coming through that part of the country need spare parts. It's bolted to the desk. It's like, does this defeat the purpose of a remote? It's a foot from the TV. Well, at least I didn't have to walk all the way over there. I'm dragging the end table around the room. I was at one place in Detroit, and they had the remote not bolted down, but they had printed on it, "This will not work on your TV at home." Like, I'm changing channels in Michigan. My wife's in L.A. 2, 4, 9, 11. What the hell's going on? This will not work on your TV. In a million years, I wouldn't have thought to steal a remote from a hotel. Would you? Would you? No. I saw that printed on there. I threw it in my bag and I kept it. I did. I have it at home. I left them a note. That's okay. I got my TV from a hotel, too.
Hey, everybody. This is Jim David. Welcome to my podcast again. I want to thank all of you who have sent me such nice emails and messages that telling me that you enjoyed my novel, You'll Be Swell. It really means a lot to me. The word of mouth on the book is really, really good. People are liking it. Who knew? I didn't know what the hell I was doing when I wrote it. But you can get it on Amazon and Amazon Kindle and for your iPad or your Sony e-reader or your Nook. So that's my shameless plug for today. But today, my podcast interview is with one of my favorite comedians who I had never met, and I finally got to work with him. His name is Wayne Cotter. And I'm sure if you have ever watched late night TV with any regularity, you have seen Wayne because he's been on David Letterman 11 times. He was on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson 4 times and many times with Jay Leno. Wayne is a comedian who is really able to work for any audience, and he always kills. I've never seen him not kill. This conversation is particularly interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, I always find it interesting when comedians discuss the art of comedy just because it's my profession right now, and I always think that's interesting. But also, Wayne, in this interview, tells one of the best stories I have ever heard about how he got on the Letterman show and the serendipitous and crazy events that led to that. It's a wonderful story. But anyway, I hope you enjoy meeting Wayne Cotter.
This is not very loud. No.
Well, you're not close to it. That's your problem.
Is that...
That's right. You've got to get like this. You didn't want to interview me at all. You just wanted me to get into some intimate posture with you.
That's
here.
That's it.
I understand. I know what's going on.
Okay. You didn't really want to talk to me. You just tried to get me in here. You just wanted to get me alone. Let me see how that... I was just listening to this NPR interview with Phyllis Diller that I had. Mm-hmm. And she was talking about how she had no idea about being a comedian. It was like her husband forced her into it. But did you always want to do, I mean, were you like a little boy that looked at comics and said, I want to do that?
I never thought of doing anything in show business professionally because my dad was such a flake, and I knew it from the time I was very little. We struggled a lot, and he was a nut. Somewhere between Ralph Cramden and Jeffrey Dahmer. You know, he was a troubled person.
An attractive combo.
right. So he's, we struggled. And I was lucky enough to go to a, from the time I was in kindergarten, I was on a scholarship at a private school. So I was around a lot of sort of successful, effective parents. So my dream was to grow up and have a 9-to-5 job and an office and a house in Connecticut and a 2-car garage and all that stuff and be an engineer or something.
You just know? Like and a married man and right. like the, have the, a normal
real,
family.
The Donna Reed Show, the White Picket
Fence. Because you didn't have that when you were a kid.
Right. But I was doing, I did love jokes and I did love putting on shows. I used to make little radio shows. I had a little, an old, this is before there were cassettes, a little 3-inch reel-to-reel.
Oh, I had a reel-to-reel.
Tape recorder.
I did that too.
And I used to beg to stay up late, and it had a little lapel microphone with an alligator clip on the back of it that would hold it up, and I would hold this thing up to the speaker of the TV and record the Carson monologues, and I would listen to them with the little earphone in my bed over and over and over again. So I really was a very young kid, and I was memorizing the 2000-Year-Old Man albums by the time I was 7-8 years old.
My idols when I was a kid was not Carson so much, but Phyllis Diller and Jonathan Winters.
Right.
I said, well, if I was a woman, that's who I'd be.
Right.
You know what I mean? If I wouldn't be a pretty girl, I'd be that. I'd right. be this wacky lady. And just the, just
and the, I looked at Carson and said, if I was a man, that's who I'd be.
And Jonathan Winters was my idol because of the characters and the voices.
Right.
And he didn't tell jokes.
No.
You know, he did like sketches and, you know, and so I was, but I had no idea that I was going to be a comedian. I thought I was going to be an actor.
Well, that's closer to where you wound up.
Yeah.
Then for me, who I thought by the time I was 18, I was absolutely sure. I used to boast to my friends and everything. I'd say, you know, you guys don't know what you're going to do. You know, everybody was going off to college, and it's like, who knows what the huge future holds. And,
right.
you know, nobody picked a major or anything. And I'm studying electrical engineering. I'm going to be an engineer. I got my whole future all planned out. You guys are all at 6s and 7s, but I've got a plan. So clearly, you know, it's one of those A, not A things. You know, nobody's telling me. What I'm going to be doing, I know exactly what I'm going to be doing, and, you know, it turned out completely different.
Well, how did it start?
I started performing when I was, like, 10 or 11. I started doing magic shows at children's birthday parties. I put a little ad in the paper, in my neighborhood newspaper, the Riverdale Press. 10-year-old magician available for birthday parties and other engagements.
You're kidding.
That's exactly what it said.
And other engagements.
Yes, I remember I had to count the word, yes, other engagements. Like, you know, I'll do birthday parties, or a Viennese ball, if you're having one, you know. So, yes, and I charged $3. But you know what? I wasn't bad.
Where was this?
In the Bronx.
Oh, in Riverdale.
In Riverdale, yeah.
Oh, in Riverdale, New York.
That's okay. Where I grew up, yeah.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. Not of privilege. There's two halves of Riverdale.
That's correct.
There's the kids that live in the apartment buildings, which I was one of. And then there's a bunch of, you know, people in estates.
And then there's the Hebrew right, home right. for the ages.
Those kids all had blues bands in high school. The kids in the mansions, you know.
Oh, really?
I'm so down and out. You, shut up.
Shut up.
Yeah. So that's really how I started performing. And then when I was, by the time I was a senior in high school, I had a little couple of commercial parodies that I used to just do for my friends. And I got up at a talent show in high school and actually, you know, with the giant 40-pound microphone, the assembly microphone at
yeah.
the school, you know, and it killed. You know, it was amazing.
What commercial parodies? What were they?
Actually, it was two bits. One was a commercial parody for there was ads on TV. This was the beginning of those late night ads. There wasn't even such a thing as 800 numbers then. It was they would just give you a phone number over and over and over again, and then a different one for New Jersey. So that was my, oh boy, these, I can't remember the thing.
But oh, because I remember
like,
mine.
These, and instead of Wolin Mirror Works, I called it Swollen Mirror Works.
Because I used
Wolin Mirror Works of Indianapolis, Indiana. Swollen Mirror Works will provide you with these luxurious wall mirrors. I was working on my little announcer voice.
I used to imitate Don Pardo when I was a kid. You know, well, Bill, you'll be staying at the fabulous Fountainblow Hotel.
I think every comic, when they start out, has their announcer bit.
That,
you know, and both of these bits were announcer bits. One was the you know, these wall mirrors for only 69 cents a square millimeter.
Well, I used to do the it's the new Miracle Brush with its patented nylon rotating head. Enables you to brush both ways. Only brush in direction of arrow. Never needs a refill and sells for only $9.99. Mm-hmm. Removes all types of pet hair instantly. Miracle Brush from K-Tel. You remember that?
Yeah, no, I don't remember that one in particular, but yes, I even had an idea.
Or you get the Ginsu knife, the matching carving fork, and now how much would you pay?
Right. And I used to make little ads on. I would make little tapes, little ads of those things, or little parody ads. One was for I subscribed to all these nerd magazines. I was a science nerd, so I had all these engineering things and popular science and all these things. They had ads in them for the Cleveland Institute of Electronics, where you could go and it was a mail order school for learning electronics. And I made on my little tape recorder, boy, if I could unearth this tape someday from storage or something. So that, and I killed with that at my little high school talent show. Also, I was too shy to actually try to be in the shows, and probably too socially awkward.
There
was
like the plays.
There was a club of the cool kids, that would all be in Anything Goes and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And I was in those.
Right.
Right.
But I would work on the stage crew because I love being around it.
So where did you, well then what was your first open mic as a comic or something?
Well, when I got to college, I started doing a radio show. I went down to the radio station and I was doing a Sunday night radio show there. And then I started doing an all-night show. This is how serious of a college student I was, where I would take phone calls and just riff with the people about whatever was going on. Mm-hmm. So that was a little bit, again, dancing around the edges of that. I actually went down to see Robert Klein, who came to play at the Bijou in Philadelphia, a little 350-seat club down there. And I went to meet him after the show. I'd never set foot in a nightclub before, And he was very nice, and I said, I want to be a comedian and thing, and I kind of think like you, and I think, blah, blah, blah. And he gave me great advice. He said, so go, 90% of it you're going to learn just by getting up in front of people trying to do it. Really, you're going to find any place you can get up in front of people and do it? I said, well, I'm doing a comedy radio show on the radio. He said, you want to be in radio? That's great. Do that. You'll prepare for radio. I said, no, I really want to do well. Then find a place to get up in front of people and do it. So I went back to my, I was in school, and I organized in the basement of my dormitory building once a month, the first Sunday of every month, little nightclub that's still there, or was still there the last time I was there.
At college.
At the University of Pennsylvania in the basement of Harnwell House called the Rat Cellar, I called it. I used to do Tom Lehrer songs and, whatever. We did all kinds of crazy things. So, yeah, that was the beginning for me. It was actually emceeing at that little club. And then around 1975, I guess I was there was a place that opened in Philadelphia called Grandma Minnie's. That was a deli. But on Wednesday nights,
they had a comedy night.
The guy, Neil Schwartz, that owned it, liked to have comedians in there, and comics would come down from New York to MC.
Really?
Yeah. I met Rick Overton there. Rich Hall used to come down and MC that thing. So that now you had real comics, and then you had a bunch of really crappy local Philadelphia comedians. It wasn't much competition, but it was pretty clear right away that I was one of the guys that could at least,
you could
do something. And it was more commercial parodies. It wasn't anything that great. I did well enough that I didn't feel...
Right.
I didn't just feel like
well. Then when did you make the plunge into New York City?
Well, that was it was a long road. I mean, I was still in engineering school. I got out of school, went to work for a computer company in New Jersey, married my first girlfriend, had the house in New Jersey, the house in the suburbs, very nice.
You had
the 2-car garage and the 9-to-5 job, and I couldn't believe it when I walked past reception every day and wave at the lady, and I had a coffee cup and a stapler and fluorescent lights, and I was in heaven. I couldn't even, my dad never went to a place like that. I mean, to me, it was just, I couldn't even believe that I had that.
You actually wanted that.
Gotten past the, yes, absolutely.
See, I didn't identify with the Donna Reed show. I identified with the Addams Family. I wanted to have this wacky, well, see, what it was, what it really was when I saw Midnight Cowboy when I was 16. Mm-hmm. I went to a drive-in,
mm-hmm.
and I said, I want to go to New York City and hang around on street corners and pick up strangers and go to parties with crazy people and do drugs.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Like they did in Midnight Cowboy, and that's what I did.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you're a much more colorful person than me. I wanted a cubicle.
That's not very colorful.
Yeah. But I was good at that, too. At the same time, a guy that I knew in Philly had been around the open mic. I had been going to some open mic, and I thought, well, if this idiot can make a living doing stand-up comedian, what am I doing sitting here? And so I quit my job.
You just quit it?
Yeah. And at the same time, there was a weird little comedy war going on in Philadelphia between two different groups of amateur guys that had opened these little clubs, and if you worked one, you couldn't work the other, and there were all kinds of meetings and things, and I sat there, I would go to these things, and I thought, what am I doing? I have no interest in being involved in this small time. I remember being, looking at the, oh, we got two little comedy clubs, across the street. Oh, if you work for this one, you can't work. This is such crap. This isn't real show business. This would never happen. Cut to, you know, 15 years later, and I'm caught in the middle between the Letterman show and the Tonight Show. People are fighting all... So it was exactly the same thing. As it turned out, it was exactly the same.
God. Just,
yeah. But...
But you were, were you divorced at this point?
I gave up the house, got divorced, yeah, and I was.
But how long was it then? I mean, and when did? Because your first manager was Jack Rollins and Charles Joffe.
Well, that was it. Was from the time I started really in 81, February of 81. It was 6 years because it was the end of February of 87 when I got on the Letterman show.
Doing Letterman for your first big, that was like a big thing.
It was a big thing. And it went great. It was kind of an amazing week. You want to hear that story?
Yeah.
Oh boy. Well, my mom was actually in the hospital, and I was working at the. Did you ever work at the Comedy Cafe in D.C.?
Oh sure.
Yeah.
On
yeah,
K Street
for Dan Harris.
Yeah.
15th and K.
K Street
above the strip joint Archibald's.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And so, and my wife was down there with me, and we decided to spend Sunday just hanging out in D.C. We went to the art museum, you know. And took like the last train we could take that I could make it for my spot at Dangerfield's that night. So I came in like kind of a mess, like at the last minute at 9 o'clock at Dangerfield's. And HBO was there looking at comics, and I was really not fully focused and concentrated. And I went up and did a set that I was not that happy about. It was fine, but not great.
You know? Right.
And Rodney came over and said something to me like, because he liked me a lot and knew, you know, and nobody told me that there was this showcase happening there that night. And so he goes, yeah, you gotta work on your editing. You gotta editing, you know. So I thought, oh, God, you know what I mean? Rodney's telling me I need more editing and, you know, and this is just, I felt just horrible. Just horrible. I felt like it was the end of my life, you know. Just
sure.
Like, oh, what a disaster. I was so stupid. I should have come back earlier and not cut it to the last minute for the gig. And it's just a spot at, you know, it's a stupid $20 spot at Dangerfield's. What, am I going to kill myself to get back there for, you know, I wasn't thinking about it. My wife and I sit around talking about it. I finally calm down.
This is your second wife.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is, yeah. By then you were remarried to your current Lucy.
Lucy, yes. Yeah. We stay out on Sunday night because I'm freaked out. We like go out to get something to eat or something.
Right.
I get back late, 2 a.m.
Right.
Something like that. I get like almost no sleep, and I get a call at like 7 a.m. from my brother. My mom at that time had been kind of in and out of the hospital, and she was back in a hospital, and we didn't even know. And she was in a hallway somewhere in the wrong hospital. They didn't have a room for her. There was all this crazy stuff going on. And I had to, like, jump up, drive over to where she was and try to get that all fixed up. Spend the whole day. I can't get the hospital to release her. It's like all this crazy, crazy stuff is going on. So it was just this sort of slam bang, you know, all this crazy stuff happening. I had this weird thing happen at Dangerfield's that night. I the crack of dawn, I'm, like, dealing with my mom in this kind of pain. It was like a movie, you know what I mean? It's just like there's no second where nothing is hacked. It's just one thing after another. And finally, I argue with these hospital people. I get them to release my mother to get her transported to the hospital she belongs at. Then I can't get an ambulance because it's a snowy day in New York. And on those days, the ambulances are all booked up. And so finally, I can't get an ambulance to transport her. The hospital won't transport her. I finally get an ambulance. It takes hours. I'm working the phone, you know, and I finally get an ambulance. And I remember that it made me laugh. The guy goes, yeah, it's $500 plus tolls. Like, oh. Yeah, $500 cash plus tolls. I said, oh, well, fine. I'll give you $1.25 for the toll. You know, I'll throw it. So we get my mom to the right hospital, the thing. They have to test her and get her all settled in, all this kind of stuff. We finish at 3 a.m. I get home 3 a.m. Completely just a wreck. And there's like 14 messages on my answering machine. Remember the answering machines?
Yes.
Back in those days?
I remember them very well.
It's a bunch of progressively hysterical messages from Kathy Vesapoli, who's booking the comedians for the Letterman show. I've gotten the show. This is my... I didn't even know they'd even seen me.
What?
Yes.
They just gave it to you.
Rick Messina... There used to be... there was a Wednesday night gig at Rascals in
of course.
In West Orange.
In West Orange.
Yes. Where they shot it for a local cable show. It was a public access.
Yes, I
show.
Remember. I was on it.
Right, and
live from
you
Rascals.
Got paid $75.
Yes,
And they shot it. It was a three-camera shoot.
Live from Rascals.
Right. And they paid you $75, but for $75, you could buy a copy of the tape. So you got right. You wound up with nothing. I do this show, and, and it turns out it's a good thing I did the show, because Messina, who was Tony Camacho and Rick Messina, were booking that thing.
Yeah.
And Rick, unbeknownst to me, sent that tape to the Letterman people. So they had seen it, and that's why they called me. So I listen to these messages now, and it's, "Hey, Wayne, this is Kathy Vespoli. I've been calling around, and I know you're in town, but we just can't reach you. We can't find where you are, but I know you're here." And this is, this is pre-cell phone, really. I mean, people had cell phones, but I didn't have
them. No, they didn't. They didn't have them then.
And they were $2,500.
Yeah, exactly.
Please call me when you get this, because you're doing the Letterman show tomorrow. Right. I'm like, what? So, that's why I tried to give you the background of this, that I'm just in this completely frantic state, and now it's 3 in the morning, I'm doing a Letterman show tomorrow. So, okay, all right, okay, I could do that, that's amazing. My wife was brushing her teeth, I walked in the bathroom, I said, I just got a Letterman show. I go back, I listen to all the messages, and it's like, where are you? We know you're here, please call me. And then the last message says, here's my home number. Whatever time you get in, call me. Don't worry about
that. That just does not happen today.
Whatever time you get in. So I call, and a guy answers the phone. Ugh. And I say, "Hi, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry to trouble you. I'm sorry to wake you, but I'm calling for Kathy Vespoli, and she asked me to try to call her in whatever time I got in. It's about the David Letterman show for tomorrow. Otherwise, I wouldn't have bothered you." And she goes, "Wayne, I'm so glad you called. Yes, you're on the show, and the limo's going to pick you up at 10 o'clock and all this stuff." So I'm okay. So we're all set. I'm doing the show tomorrow. I find out later that her...
10 o'clock a.m. or p.m.?
10 o'clock a.m.
Oh.
In the morning. They're going to pick me up in the morning. I'm going to go down to the show. I have to, figure out, pull some clothes together, whatever, and So I went down and I meet, Morty. I'd met him before. I had gone up
the
there
producer.
Once. Right. I had gone up there one time with Leno when he was a friend, and he invited me to come with him when he was doing the Letterman show. So I'd been up there before.
Right.
But I didn't really think anybody knew me or anything. I didn't know what was going on. And Morty says, "We have these meetings." He told this story for the longest time too, because people would say, "You can't get on the show. It's all who you know. It's all bullshit, all this stuff." And he would always say, "Look, Wayne Cotter, we saw the tape, we booked him, because we liked what he was doing." I was the example that they would use. If you got what we want, we'll book you. That's all Wayne had to do. We saw the tape, we liked it, we booked him. And that's basically what he told me. He said, "We have these meetings, and everybody hates it, because the whole staff has to come. Everybody has to sit, and we watch a bunch of tapes, and we only get through a minute or two of most of these guys." And he said, "This has never happened before. We watched your entire tape."
You're kidding.
And you killed every... even as I was coming in, like a receptionist, like these, women at desks are going like, "Oh my God, you're so funny." I was like, "What? How did you... What?" They had all... I was just a hit in that office.
Astonishing.
Yeah. And so that's how I got booked. It was like a crazy dream.
That is luck.
Dream.
That is a crazy dream.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
just does not happen.
Well, I guess unless you're just fabulous. That's right. So we go through my tape and we pick out some bit. I don't have a set put together.
Right.
And
we
pick out the bits that they
want.
Thought would be good for this. One of them was an AIDS joke, which had been it was about from the very beginning of AIDS. I had this joke because there used to be these chocolate diet candies that were called AIDS, AYDS.
Right.
And that was my joke, just think of this company that spent years, because those, again, it was a commercial thing. They've been advertising this for years. And my joke was, can you imagine, the board of directors, has a meeting, I can't believe they named a fatal disease after us. Why couldn't it have been Doritos?
And they let you do that on the...
And they wanted me to do it, and I didn't want to do it, because at that point... This is 87
people
now.
People were dying.
This is this was something that had been in that tape, and I had done it in that show, but I really, really didn't want to do it. And they called the famous standards and practices guy, the guy you read about in the books about SNL, and, the guy comes in, he's the real suit, and he comes down, and they play the tape for him. They play that joke. I say, "Why didn't they have fatal disease after?" He says, "Oh, no, that's fine, because he's saying what it is. It's a fatal disease. That's what it is." So I actually did do that joke. on my first Letterman shot. But thankfully, it was buried amongst a lot of other very strong stuff. Set was way too long too, because first of all, I didn't know I was going to kill, which I did. It's just, you know, I hadn't run the set. I didn't really have a good timing. And Leno called me, you know, great stuff, but you did two shots. What are you doing? You did two shots. But what happened was, I go down to the Letterman show that day. I meet the people. I get the thing. We put together the thing. I get in makeup. I put on my suit. Paul Schaefer comes in. I find out that Paul Schaefer is the guy that I had woken in the middle of the night, by the way.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah. He comes in and says, you know, what song do you want? I have no idea. You know, the whole thing was just, it's like a crazy dream. It was really fun. And I'm all set to do the show. Barbara Walters is the first guest. She's a nervous wreck because, especially at that time, Letterman had this reputation of being this, you know, unpredictable, just this crazy loose cannon that might go crazy on you. And, you know, she was actually nervous. It was funny to see her nervous because she's sort of in the green room. She's famous for making other people cry.
I know.
You know. So she goes on, and somehow she's so anxious, she gets herself tongue-tied and winds up saying all kinds of things she didn't mean to say about her relationship with Harry Reasoner. And, you know, Letterman kind of didn't mean to bring it up. I don't know what happened, but the thing got so funny, and it was this sort of one of these spontaneous things that was just so crazy, and they wound up going way long, and I got bumped.
Oh, so you didn't do
the show?
I got
bumped. That's right. And so, you know, more.
This was your first Letterman.
My first shot. And I got through this whole thing, and now it's like, you're not on. I'm sorry.
Oh, you mean you taped it?
I never taped it. I never went on. I never went on that day.
You never did?
No. The shot that I'm telling you about that I wound up ultimately doing was not that day. So they go, we're really sorry, you know, but we're gonna book you again. And by the time I get home, they call me, and they say, you're on tomorrow. All right. Okay. Great. Okay, great. So I, next day, go down, all set, you know, hello security guard, you know, hide everything. Now I'm like, just not going to work, you know, it's my job now. You know, so I go down there, bumped again. Tony Randall this time, everything kind of goes crazy, and they're having such a, and this time Letterman himself actually apologized to me. He actually, he's such a decent guy, really. He really mm-hmm. was, and he was like, I'm really sorry. I it was my fault. I just got carried away. I didn't keep track. And I said, you know what? I'm still emceeing the open mic night on Wednesday nights in Philly. And I said, you know what? I emcee the open mic night in Philly, and sometimes I start screwing around, and people are waiting to get on and all this kind of stuff, and I forget, and then it's the same thing. You're just kind of in the moment. I totally
right.
get it. And he went like, he just looked at me. He said, you really do? I said, yeah. He said, thanks. Okay.
Oh, that's
so it was
nice.
Like, yeah, it was just like a nice moment, you know. Next morning, 11 o'clock, they call, you're on today.
This is 3 days in a row.
3 days in a row. And so,
Jesus.
So, right. So there's, so now we're now I'm down there, and now I'm just completely, I got my feet up, you know. I'm completely, I'm eating all the crap in the green room, you know. I don't care. And Letterman starts the show, and he says, we, tonight, when he's, you know, billboarding the show at the beginning, he goes, tonight we have a guy who's become a regular on our show without ever appearing on the program. So it's great. It's just because the thing has been set up so perfectly, you know, and throughout the show he keeps going, he keeps making jokes, you know, and of course, don't forget, later, Wayne Cotter, maybe. So this just keeps going and going, and, you know, so
that was like, that's astonishing, because that's like you had this legendary status.
That's right, that's right.
Like
before
you were,
I ever...
You were mythic.
Right, it exactly. Like I couldn't have asked for a better...
And so you finally got on them.
I got on that night.
Night three. And you killed.
He introduced me. I came out and I made like an ad lib. I said, boy, my family's been going, because I had a thing about my family I was going to do in the beginning. So I said, my family's been going through a lot this this week. And, you know, the people laugh. And it's so, okay, fine. I'm off and running. I was pretty comfortable and went unbelievable. You know, went over, sat on the panel. You know, Letterman, you know, kind of gushing and stuff. And come back anytime. And that was great. And wow, you know, it's everything you get. My wife took a picture and we went back to the green room right after. And there's no picture of me in the world that looks like this. I'm grinning ear
to
ear.
And you ended up doing the show how many times over the years?
I think 11.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then what? And then what happened? How'd you get the Tonight Show with Carson?
They saw me. I was in L.A. and Jim McCauley saw me at the Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa Beach. Yeah, but that was a huge thing. And then I got to go on with Johnny.
And how many times
so,
did you do it with Johnny?
Johnny, I think, was four, and then with Jay, another nine or something. So
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. I know.
That's huge.
Yeah. So that's my little first Letterman shot story.
That's too much. That's too funny.
It was an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, everybody should have a week in their life like that. That was pretty unbelievable.
But then how did the gig on hosting Comic Strip Live on Fox happen?
I had just auditioned to host Studs and was dressed in a suit trying to look all hosty and had to run over to get to my spot at the Laugh Factory that night. I got up and did my spot, and the executive producer of Comic Strip Live was under some kind of threat from the network that he needed to replace the host that he had hired in a big fat hurry, or he was going to be out the door. I had been on Comic Strip Live once as a guest, so they knew me, and I did my set, and, you know, I did well, and Ken asked me if I wanted to host, if I was interested in hosting Comic Strip Live, and I said yes, and that's what I was doing for the next 3.5 years.
But you just, these things just happen to you. It seems like no effort was required.
I slaughter Christian babies at home. I have a whole ritual. There's a pentagram on the floor.
Yes, I no. should. I think I'm going to start doing that.
No, I was, you know, look, it's like anybody that succeeds at anything, you have to attribute some portion of it to luck and some portion of it to whatever you brought. I was lucky enough to have been born with some combination of desire and ability to do this crazy thing.
Yeah.
And whatever those circumstances were. And I had a fair amount of good fortune.
Right. Well, yeah. When you started being a comedian, did you make a conscious choice to be clean with your material?
The first paying gigs I could pick up, when I was starting out in Philadelphia, the best paying gigs from the New York area, this guy Jerry Stanley was booking these sort of one-nighters in bars in New Jersey. And you could go up and get $55, you know, for
right.
one of these. And I went up and I did a couple of them. And the acts were so crude.
Just filthy.
And I'm not a prude. I'm really not. You know, people think I am. I even had one extremely famous comedian that I was working with on the road as we were walking back to the hotel, and he was talking to his road manager about pussy or something, you know. And he actually turned to me and apologized. He said, "I'm sorry, Wayne, but, you know." I said, "Oh, yeah, because, you know, they were the single guys, and as a married guy, I wouldn't know anything about pussy." So, okay. And so, but the guys always had, they go, "Wing, he's the clean guy. I'm the pastor, you know." You know, "Oh, we can't say that in front of him, you know." But I was never like that. It was just always my, I think I was thinking in terms of getting on the Tonight Show. That was really my dream. What are you going to do? I mean, I was wrong. I used to love Gilbert Gottfried to Catch a Rising Star all the time. And I would go like, he's never going to do anything with this. What can you do with that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I was wrong about that. You know, he didn't need to tailor himself to that. He didn't want to go into that particular box. You know,
right.
I wanted to be in that. And it's sort of like wanting to be in the cubicle in the computer thing. I wanted to be in the, you know, straight stand-up Johnny Carson show box.
Right.
If I'm going to do this different thing, it has to be that I'm bringing something to the world that I feel good about. I don't mean to be highfalutin about it. I mean, I'm just telling jokes. But there was no debate for me about whether I wanted to kill at Freddy's in New Jersey.
Yeah,
you know, This is.
I hated that too. I hated all those gigs, and I did them for the money,
right?
And because I was used to a theater audience, and I was like, really, is this what I'm going to be entertaining? Those people in the audience became everybody that had ever abused me,
right?
Do you know what I mean? Everybody that had ever made fun of me,
right?
They assumed that personality, and it was like part of me was like, I'm going to get these people, and so. So,
yeah, I know there's people that feel that. I never came from that place. I don't know.
You're lucky.
I mean, it is. Stand-up comedy is this weird, passive-aggressive
mm-hmm.
art form.
It's a defense.
It's right. And so there's no question that I have, I'm sure I have, like, anger that I don't deal with properly or something. And so it comes out through this great thing of being able to do this stand-up. And I don't really care. You know? Yeah. But I never. Listen, don't get me started on what's edgy and what's dangerous and all this, you know. Lenny Bruce went to jail for saying a certain word, you know.
Right.
And now the guys today, oh, man, no, I worship Lenny Bruce. That's why I've got to get out there and, like, say these things because I... Really, if you worship Lenny Bruce, saying those things now is your ticket to an HBO special. It's the safest thing you can do. So instead, find something else that's risky and do that. Get up there and make fun of HBO.
Right.
You know? Do that. Talk about Time Warner.
Right. I don't consciously try to be edgy at all. I just do what amuses me.
Right.
Sometimes I find things funny that is considered edgy, but it's nowhere near. I mean, everything I'm doing is
very
safe.
I don't know what would count as edgy now. I don't know what would be legitimately, you know, outside the box of what you would expect a comedian to try to say. But when a guy gets up there and talks about various bodily functions or explicit stuff about sex or, you know, trashes women or does some kind of racist thing or religion thing or what, it used to be talking about drugs was a big, you know, taboo, you know, once upon a time.
That's true.
Yeah, I guess it used to be a lot more. My first day at Comic Strip Live, my first day I walked into the office, and here I'm seeing a show that has five comedians every week.
You know? Yeah.
And there was a big, big conversation going on in this. They were in a meeting room with a blackboard. They had to come up with a euphemism for balls. And they have 30 of them written out on the blackboard, and there's this very earnest conversation going on. You know, love nuggets, cojones, you know, I don't know, they had a million of these things. So they're all sitting, well, what do you think? Will cojones work? Should we do that? This is like serious producer talk, comedy producer talk. Yes, what word are we going to use for this thing? Oh my God, what have I gotten into here? Look, what counts as edgy and dangerous, I mean, I get it. I was in the Aristocrats, you know. Mm-hmm. I get it. I think that's fun. I think that did push the envelope in terms of people's expectations a little bit. It was surprising, and it just... Dirty stuff aside, hearing 100 comedians tell the same joke, each in their own way,
right,
is just a great sort of postmodern exercise.
Right, you know? Exactly.
As long as not everybody's trying to do the exact same thing that I'm doing, then that's fine with me. I mean, I don't begrudge it. I don't think they shouldn't be doing it. I don't have an attitude about it. It's just not ever what I wanted to do. You know?
Well, I think that, don't you think it's harder to get a big, huge laugh with a clean joke?
In a club, yes.
Because the club audiences are expecting something a little dirtier.
Right. But the club audience is actually a narrow audience. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very small sector of the potential audience. And so I grew up under the influence of Leno as a comedian.
Right.
And so it was always about... You know how you always get those guys that come over after the show and go like, you are so funny. That was great. You're really funny. You're funny, man. You're just like Frank at my office. You know? And then you say, well, thank you, you know. But you know, really... You know, Frank is funny because Frank's making fun of the broken handle on the water cooler that they all know about that's been there for 2 years, and they can't believe that, you know, Jim, the maintenance guy, hasn't fixed the thing yet, but he's a drunk and he's got a joke about that. And, you know, they've all got all this shared experience, so he's drawing on all of that. And, of course, the challenge of a comedian is to somehow create that feeling among a group of people that actually don't know each other at all and don't have, and find whatever those shared things are that connect you to each other. And if I'm really getting, you know, puffed up about what good stand-up comedy, or really I think any kind of good theater, does, is that it's not only the connection between what's happening on stage and a person in the audience, but actually all the people in the audience sharing it with each other.
Right, exactly. You know? Well, it's been such a joy to watch you and get to know you and
oh, well, thanks.
And learn from you and learn and just to watch what you're doing.
That's what I always say. Watch and learn. That's what I tell all the comics.
That's
No.
Of course not.
That's the title of my new album. Watch and Learn.
Right.
Wayne Cotter in concert.
Right.
No. Yeah, no, it's been nice working with you.